They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Sarah Kustok is back. Yes Network, FS1. She does a whole lot of stuff involving basketball. Hello again, Sarah.
Hey, Mannix. How are you?
I'm good.
It's great to see you. Great to talk with you. I feel like it's been a while.
It's been at least several weeks, if that's all, at least a couple of weeks. But we do have a lot to talk about. The NBA trade deadline in the books, a lot coming up in the next couple of weeks with the buyout market starting to kind of round into shape. As always, if you're listening to this podcast, subscribe, rate, review, best way to support it every single week. But I guess, Sarah, like just as we kind of know where everything's fallen right now, I want to look at some of the winners and losers here. I guess first, give me your big winner of the trade deadline. Who do you stands out?
I've got two for you. When I was making my list of winners and losers, I realized I had a lot more winners in the column, some more than others. But I'm going to give you two. I'm going to give you one from the East and one from the West. My East winner is Miami. My East winner is really Andre Iguodala, but yes. I'm not going to pick an individual. But it goes without saying that he's the big winner, given the fact that he got a chance to have a little time off, sign a nice extension. I will be the first to say I never would have anticipated that, despite knowing what Pat Riley has done in the past, Eric Spoelstra, how he runs things, the team that they had, I never would have anticipated they would be sitting where they are right now in the Eastern Conference and playing the way that they are, especially with a lot of those rookies and young players. So the fact that they were able to add, we're going to have to wait and see the type of condition, shape, how Andre Iguodala rounds into form and just all of that. Jay Crowder, I think, is a solid piece to add in the mix and have at your disposal in the lineup or as an option within the course of how they go about what they use for the rotation. I just think having the playoff experience and veteran presence when you're looking at players like Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, Kendrick Nunn, those who have played so well this season, the fact that you're bringing in the veteran playoff experience to add to the mix along with Jimmy Butler, the leadership that he has, of course, how Bam Adebayo is playing. You could go down the list of the different pieces, the contracts that they got off of, the fact that, you know, you get off the contract of Dion Waiters. Don't like the fact that you lose Justice Winslow, but what they lost in terms of what they gained now, the way that their roster sits, I think it was a big time move for a Miami team that I didn't expect to say that I would look at them as one of the, I still think, you know, Milwaukee is far and away the best team in the East. But to me, Miami has put themselves in position to be a top, you know, the one or two top of the group, that 2 through 6, sitting behind Milwaukee.
I agree with you with Miami, but I call it like a winner with an asterisk because you know what they were trying to do. I mean, they were trying to get Iguodala and they wanted Danilo Gallinari as well. And Gallinari would have been the kind of offensive boost that might have put them, I think, on that same level as Milwaukee, or
wow,
at least get them closer
I think
Gallo's a 20 point per game scorer this year. I mean, he's an inside out threat who can make 3-point shots and, you know, not a great defensive player, but that's not what you're really bringing him in for. I think that would have been a weapon that moved them, you know, an inch them even closer to Milwaukee, and you could sense it. I mean, I wasn't on the conference call that Pat Riley had after the trade deadline, but you know, you read some of the comments, and you could sort of you know, sense the regret in his voice
that he
couldn't get a deal like that done. So you get Iguodala. That's certainly useful. Early returns are. He looks like he's in pretty good shape. I saw him say that he hasn't played 5-on-5 since last June. Okay. All right. Well, let's see how long that takes to get back into game shape. But he looked okay in his first game out. Jay Crowder's in shape, and Jay Crowder looked great in his first game with Miami, and I think he'll be
well. And
an
you
asset
saw him up
positions.
Close and personal with Boston. I mean, for as much as you're around Boston, and saw what you know.
He's just an inconsistent 3-point shooter. I mean, some nights he can be really good. Other nights, you know, I don't know what you're going to get.
But that's where I think there's a balance. That's what I like. There's about you got knockdown 3-point shooters in Hero and in Robinson and in some of the other. That's why I just like the mix of you're bringing in some other veterans and you're bringing in some other players that have that type of postseason experience that I think you'll need with that group. The other winner, I'm going to give you the other winner so we're not on this forever. The LA Clippers. And I think that's a lot of people have talked about that or talked about with them and picking up Marcus Morris. I just think I am really high on the Los Angeles Clippers, despite some of the ways they're still trying to meld together, get healthy, you know, Kawhi and Paul George acclimating with one another, all the things that they're still working towards and maybe not at the level or at the type of continuity that they would want to be at this point of the season. I'm a huge fan of Marcus Morris's game. The fact that he's shooting a career 3-point percentage this year, the toughness, the grit that he brings, like the identity that the Clippers have had and they want to continue to have, I think he fits in perfectly with that. It's been said before, but you got another body to throw at LeBron James if that's kind of who you're targeting, thinking about the postseason and thinking about the playoffs, you know, playoff experience. I think all of those things. Also, the fact that he didn't go to the Lakers, you know, you pick up a guy that maybe they would have coveted. So I think there's a variety of things. The fact that, you know, you're able to continue to move towards a place, Andre Iguodala not going to the Lakers. And I keep matching this up with the Lakers, but you kind of look at, though, to me, those two teams are the two teams that I would anticipate, you know, really being head-to-head in the Western Conference. So I think for a variety of reasons, they, to me, are the big winners in the West.
Yeah, I like the deal for the Clippers for all the reasons you kind of laid out there. I mean, Morris, he's having a terrific 3-point shooting year. He's going to space the floor a little bit more around Kawhi and Paul George and open up some lanes there. You do keep him away from the Lakers, as you said, which I think is an important part of this overall discussion. He doesn't address their second unit rebounding issues. I still think when they roll Harrell out there at the five, it still creates kind of a problem on the boards, and there are a number of teams out there with real size that might beat them up. He also is kind of a ball stopper, which I think could be problematic with that Clippers team. I mean, they want to move the ball around, swing it, you know, be active with it, and that's not really Morris's game. So, you know, that's something to watch out for as he tries to fit in with that group. But look, it's addition. You know, I don't think they were getting much out of Harkless. That wasn't a big loss. And look, they had that first round pick kind of burning a hole in their pocket. Like if they didn't use that pick now, they couldn't trade a first-round pick for like 10 years or something like that, some absurd number. So, you know, getting Morris, who you could re-sign after the season. I mean, look, they liked Marcus Morris enough last summer that they offered him a 3-year deal, like $45 million. So
and
they like Marcus
he's
Morris
30?
A lot.
Like he's a good age and a good Yeah, I agree with all of that.
Yeah, so I like the deal for them. I don't love it, but I like it for the LA Clippers. My big winner is in the West too. I love what Minnesota did, and I feel like I'm in kind
Ooh,
of a.
Ooh, I like this. Tell me more.
Well, I feel like I'm in a minority here with D'Angelo Russell. It's good that you're here to talk about this because you saw Russell up close and person and personal in Brooklyn. It just feels like there's a negativity around D'Angelo Russell that people don't see him as being as good as the sum of his parts. When I look at D'Angelo Russell, I see a guy that overcame a lot, you know, when he got to Brooklyn. I mean, he had such a lousy reputation in those first couple of years in L.A., much of it of his own doing. I mean, he brought it on himself with the whole video thing with Nick Young and all that stuff that went into it. But he gets to Brooklyn, and 2 years in, he plays 81 games. He's a 20-point-per-game scorer. He's making 37% of his threes. He's an all-star, and I've heard people snicker, well, he's an injury replacement all-star. I don't care. Do we say pro bowlers are pro bowlers because, you know, guys step off the stage and don't want to be in the Pro Bowl? No, he was an all-star. He might be the 13th all-star, but he was still an all-star. Then he goes to Golden State, and he's putting up really big numbers there as well, but afterwards you hear like Steve Kerr say, well, it wasn't a great fit for us, and you see some just some negative slanted comments or stories coming out about D'Angelo Russell. Look, if you're Minnesota, you have been chasing D'Angelo Russell for the better part of like 8 months. Like ever since free agency hit last summer, you have been after D'Angelo Russell. So I got to believe that Gerson Rosas, the GM out there in Minnesota, he's got to see something. He's got to believe that Russell fits in with what the Timberwolves are trying to do. You have Karl-Anthony Towns, who has got to be looking around prior to the trade, being like, what did I get myself into with this five-year contract extension? You go out and you get one of, if not his best friend in the league. Now, not only do you have a happy Karl Towns, but you have two players playing key positions under the age of 25 who are locked in for like the next 3 or 4 years. That might not be a big deal if you're in Miami or, you know, L.A., but Minnesota doesn't attract free agents. They just don't. So if you can get two guys that are all-star level players locked in at somewhat reasonable contract, I know they're max guys, but those aren't absurd max contracts. I look at this as being a huge win for Minnesota. It may not pay dividends this year, but you know, in the coming years, I think they've at least given themselves a couple of guys to build around.
I will say this, having watched D'Angelo Russell up close and personal day in, day out for a couple of years when he was with Brooklyn. And obviously, and I've talked about him at length on a variety of occasions while he was with the Nets, also with the trade to the Warriors. And I think there was always a slant of like, oh, well, you call the Nets game, so you got to say this. To watch him grow and mature, the way he was willing to be coached, how he embraced the idea of getting better, his game and the ways in which he continued to understand his strengths and weaknesses and how he was trying to look to improve those. And I think when people look at his game, and I will say that his game is different than a lot of other point guards that you see in the league or those that thrive. He doesn't have the same type of explosiveness, bursts, getting to the rim. And how he works a pick and roll is a little different just in his savvy. I mean, I think people see him because he's lean. He's 6'5". Like, he's tall. He's got length. His ability to get off a shot is not just because he can create space, but he could shoot over guys. He's never played with a big. I mean, the idea of him in Karl-Anthony Towns in a pick and roll, a guy that could stretch the foot. Most of the bigs that he's played with were more rollers. Like the pick and roll was a big rolling. I think about how well he played with Jared Allen or Ed Davis last year. Those were when he was a all-star, and you say all-star, I agree with your concept about all-star. But those weren't bigs that were stretching the floor. So now you give him room to operate with a guy like Karl-Anthony Towns. I think there's a lot of positive. I know the big knock, or, you know, the area of concern with both those guys, understandably so, is what's your defense going to look like? But Russell has improved in that area. I don't think he has a tremendous amount of lateral quickness whereby he's going to ever be a great defender, but he'll try. And I think throughout the course of his career, he's understood that. And we see a lot of guys that aren't always terrific on the defensive end. That's why it's pivotal to try and build your team and build your roster and build your lineups with other guys that fit that mold and fit those pieces. But I think the last thing about that, as you said, you can never underestimate what it can do for a team, for a group that have guys that genuinely like each other and care about each other and will play for each other and are happier in the setting because they are amongst their friends or amongst people that they care about. D'Angelo Russell going back, I mean, Pablo Prigioni on the Minnesota staff now with Ryan Saunders, who I think Russell and Saunders will be a great fit together. But Russell, that was his coach in Brooklyn. So now he's back with Prigioni, who's in Minnesota. I just think there's a variety of things where you never know. And this is, you know, you could understand why some of the people have that hesitation they do about how this will work out. But I think in all sense, Karl-Anthony Towns is your guy if you're in Minnesota. So the fact that you're going to go all in on what you could do to help make him happy and keep him in a circumstance and a situation that he wants to be in and wants his guys around him. I do think that's all positive, and I have high hopes for what D'Angelo Russell will continue to become in that system.
And you get off the Wiggins contract. Like, that's another part of all this.
Yes, yes. And I think, I'm not down on, I also am optimistic. I think change of scenery, like, so much for so many guys. And I think the same thing with Russell coming to Brooklyn. Like, sometimes guys, where they were picked in the draft, so much of the perception is based on where they were picked in the draft. And obviously the Wiggins contract is huge. But if you're willing to pay that, which some guys don't have great contracts, I think he's going to be a fine fit. I think it's a better fit for him with the Warriors than it, you know, you tried in Minnesota, didn't work out. So a change of scenery, I think, can always be a positive thing. We've seen that. We've seen that throughout, you know, year after year throughout many cases in the league. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I mean.
But I'm optimistic that those two guys will be in better circumstances and it will better benefit the teams than what was happening prior.
Yeah, look, I'm with you on that one. I mean, that's why from my perspective, I don't understand why Golden State pulled the trigger this early. Because, look, as we just said, the thirst that Minnesota had for D'Angelo Russell wasn't being quenched anytime soon. Like, they have been after him since last summer. They would be after him into this summer. That's how much they wanted D'Angelo Russell. You could get probably the exact same package that Minnesota was offering now a few months from now. And if you wait a few months from now, who knows what could be available to you? Like, the Warriors stink. If they wind up with a top five pick in the draft, what might D'Angelo Russell on a max contract and the top overall pick get you? The end of the season, what happens with Philadelphia? What if they look to trade Ben Simmons? Could you get Ben Simmons instead of Andrew Wiggins? You look at what's happening in Washington. Could Bradley Beal make some noise about getting out? All of a sudden, you've got D'Angelo Russell and the top pick to maybe offer to the Wizards. I just, the deal itself doesn't bother me all that much because I think that in Golden State, Andrew Wiggins might be able to develop into something closer that he was meant to be, if that makes sense. I mean, maybe he's not going to be a facsimile of Harrison Barnes, but he could be something like that. But I just think they could have waited. And if they did wait, they might have opened up some other doors. Like, Andrew Wiggins and the number one overall pick doesn't have the same appeal, I wouldn't think, as D'Angelo Russell and the number one pick. I
mean, are you not convinced, though, that Golden State thinks that maybe they could be the team, the organization that unlocks Wiggins? I mean, he's got all the God-given talent in the world and the ability and thinking if we're looking at him as our fourth option, our fourth best guy, that he could be a tremendous fit into what we need in our starting lineup.
Yes, but again, I think they could have had this in the summer. Like, I don't have a problem with the deal itself. I just think that they potentially limited themselves by not being able to look at the whole board when it opens up in the offseason. I don't think this deal was going anywhere. Now, we can have a debate about, you know, unlocking Wiggins. And look, he is only like 24. It feels like he's been around forever, but he's only like 24. And there's still stuff there. Like, he's got good athleticism. He's just starting to shoot the three. But up until this point, he's been a long two shooter whose defense has never been as good as you kind of thought it might be. He's always, like, dazzled you with some defensive potential, but never really lived up to that potential. So maybe he turns into the real deal in Golden State and we all look like morons and Bob Myers looks smarter than all of us again. But I just don't know about the timing with all that. I want to ask you about the other side of the bracket. Like, the teams, maybe they're not losers, but the teams that kind of had the trade deadline come and go and kind of cringed at the end result of it. Who jumps to mind off the top?
There was no teams that I was really, I mean, I don't know if you would call them, there's no one that I looked at and I was like, wow, they really struck out, whether making moves or not making moves. Like, I'm not concerned because it's not my horse, but Philadelphia, like, I don't know what they could have done. I don't know what they should do. I just know that given the thoughts of what my thoughts, I will say personally, what I thought that they would be this season, and now looking at it, just how disjointed and dysfunctional it seems like it is. And I don't necessarily, I guess my point is I'm saying this without a solution. I don't know what moves they could have made or should have made or done anything at the trade deadline. I know they fortified a little bit of adding a little shooting with, you know, Glenn Robinson III and Alec Burks. But to me, it's amazing to me that they were one shot away, a couple bounces away in Toronto from potentially the trajectory of what they could have done in the postseason last year. Now you're looking at where they sit and what they could be and just all that's swirling around them. So I would put towards that column Boston. I certainly would not say that they were losers, and I know you can get into them more, but they're obviously missing that centerpiece that they've been looking for. And so the fact that they kind of stood pat, I'm not sure how that helps push them ahead, given the fact that Miami was a team that seemingly made a jump. Detroit, I'm curious. I know they're not a real sexy team to be getting into and talking about right now, but like the fact that they got what they got for Andre Drummond, who I know, I mean, that kind of puts the broader question on where centers are at and the priority of centers and how you look at things within the league. I know we'll get into Clint Capela a little bit more in Houston, but the fact that Andre Drummond's leading the league in rebounding, I think he has, what, for the past 2 years, an all-star caliber player. You look at the numbers that he puts up, he's still young, and that's the return that you get on him. So, you know, they're a team that a lot of question marks kind of see what they do in this rebuild or just kind of being sellers and breaking it all down and kind of where they go. But those were the teams that – but there was no one that I thought – there was no deal, speaking of like the Golden State and the Minnesota deal, there was nothing that I was like, oh, man, this is going to be a train wreck. There's just question marks of who didn't move forward that maybe needed to add a piece.
Yeah, I'm with you. And we'll get to Houston separately in this discussion. But look, I thought Boston, you know, they needed to do something to push themselves into real title contention. I mean, they are really tough 1-4. But when you get to the 5 spot, they've been getting good contributions from Tice and Cantor and Grant Williams. But I worry about that in the playoffs. Their bench needs shooting. I worry about that in the playoffs. So a guy like Davis Bertans, someone I know that Boston was high on. And look, I'll give the Celtics credit. I mean, they went pretty hard after Bertans. I mean, they were offering.
Does that surprise you about Washington? Do you think that's just to make sure that Bradley Beal stays happy? That surprised me because you would think that would be, I maybe thought that would have been a move that would have come to fruition. And just as an outsider.
It did surprise me just because I think the offers were pretty significant. Now, the Wizards were looking for a player and draft pick. So they weren't willing to give this guy away despite the fact that he's on an expiring contract. So they were looking for something big in return. Boston, at the very least, was willing to offer draft picks. Like, they've got 3 first-round picks in this upcoming draft. I think they were willing to part with at least 2 of them to get Davis Bertans out of Washington. But the Wizards, I mean, they, look, two big reasons internally I think they wanted to hold on to him. One, they're still in the playoff race. Like, inexplicably, they're only a couple of games back or a few games back of that final spot in the Western or in the Eastern Conference. I mean, it stinks. The 8th seed's terrible. Whoever gets it's going to be well under 500. But the Wizards are somehow, despite all the injuries, still in it. And I don't think you can justify to Bradley Beal, who just signed to a contract extension, that you're going to give up one of your better players just to get draft picks for next year. I don't think you can do that. Plus, there is a belief that, you know, they can re-sign Bertans this summer. They will have his bird rights. He'll probably get like $12 to $15 million in free agency. They re-sign him, and he'd be a good fit opposite Beal and John Wall. So those are the reasons. I mean, the offers were pretty big, and that's why, you know, I don't blame Boston for not getting him. But the Wizards, it seemed like from the jump, were determined, unless they were blown away by a player and pick package, they weren't going to give up Davis Bertans. I thought the Lakers, you know, and it's more of a combination of things. The Lakers weren't able to get Andre Iguodala. They weren't able to get Marcus Morris. And the icing on the cake is that nobody is going to get Darren Collison. And that's a pretty big blow for the Lakers to really not get anybody to join that mix. Collison, I thought, would have been a terrific fit with the Lakers. He's a terrific three-point shooter. It's not a stretch to say that within a couple of weeks, Darren Collison would have been the starting point guard in Los Angeles with the Lakers. So not getting him is a problem. The bigger loser, though, is Philadelphia. And I'm not sure what the Sixers could have done. Nobody wanted their package of like Zaire Smith and Mike Scott. Like, that wasn't going anywhere. But the Sixers right now, they're in trouble. They're in real trouble because as good as they can be defensively, they can't make outside shots. And when you get to the playoffs, teams are going to exploit the fact that Ben Simmons won't shoot and that Josh Richardson and Tobias Harris and Al Horford are not Jimmy Butler and J.J. Redick. So they're going to get, I think, get really exploited by good defensive teams in the postseason. I mean, that's a team, Sarah, that I don't know what your perspective on the Sixers is, but like they just look like they have bad chemistry. The pieces don't fit well together. There's really not a lot of positives to take away. And now they're fighting with the fans. Like you saw the thing with Joel Embiid kind of waving at the fans, telling them to be quiet. Like, all this is not a good place to be for Philadelphia.
Well, and then later came up, I mean, his, which I just think happened just last night or today, his interaction with Jimmy Butler that almost suggested about him leaving. I should get it correct, but basically saying either die the hero or become a villain. And then Jimmy Butler said, I know places that, you know, villains are welcome. And Joel said, but so that to me is that I think for a good amount of time, even with the moves that were made in the offseason, you knew that you didn't have a great fit and there was still some pieces missing, but the extreme amount of talent and the potential of what they could be on the defensive, there were so many aspects of them that you're like, gosh, if they figure it out and get it together, they could be monsters. And so to me, the greater issue is just the chemistry. Like when you have seemingly, you know, the comments of Al Horford and you know, he said he didn't want to make comments about it, but stuff happened in the locker room. Like that, to all of those inner workings, to me, supersede what the bad fit on the floor, because I think that they've got so much talent that some of that you can overcome or figure out ways. But if you've got a handful of players that aren't meshing otherwise, that to me presents more problems, I think, you know, when you're thinking about what type of run they could make during the postseason.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with some of that, but like they have some talent. But like Brett Brown's getting killed right now. Like, I'm not sure what Brett Brown's supposed to do. You can't conjure up shooters. You can't turn, you know, Tybull into a consistent three-point shooter. Josh Richardson is not going to become a consistent three-point shooter. Embiid can shoot threes, but you know, it kind of takes away from his strengths if you move that far away from the basket all the time.
Well, and that's why, right. Sorry to cut you off. As much as there was so much focus on Jimmy Butler not being there and him going to Miami, like JJ Redick, like the loss of JJ Redick to me was like, that was the one guy that unlocked so much of your offense, or at times when you needed to have someone run around and be a 3-point threat, a consistent 3-point threat. That changed a ton of the dynamic.
Yeah. It goes back for me to the fact that the Sixers made so many significant changes, in part based on a loss to Toronto that came down to a ball bouncing on the rim four times. That Kawhi Leonard shot, like that doesn't go in. Maybe the Sixers win in overtime. Maybe they go on to beat Milwaukee. Hell, maybe they win a championship with that group. That ball goes in. And Philadelphia radically reshaped its roster. I mean, J.J. Redick has said he wanted to come back. Look, Jimmy Butler's about the money. Like, Jimmy Butler got a good deal in Miami, but if he got a better one in Philadelphia, I think he would have stayed in Philadelphia. So they made sweeping changes after losing by, like, the closest possible margin of losing. Game 7 on the road with a bouncing basketball on the rim. So if this thing comes unspooled at the end of the season, if they get beat in the first round, I'm going to look back at that moment and the decisions that were made in the aftermath of that moment. I mean, you can certainly argue that the Sixers, because of how Jimmy Butler's playing, you keep that team together, they're right there with Milwaukee.
They're a
co-favorite right now.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. I agree with that statement.
I don't know. Well, we'll see what happens with Philadelphia. They can still strangle you defensively, but I just, without shooting, I don't see how they get the job done. All right, let's talk about another interesting team out there. Maybe the most interesting team as we finish this the second half of the season. The Houston Rockets, they flip Clint Capella before the trade deadline. They get Robert Covington back from Minnesota in return, and they are all in, Sarah, on the kind of small ball that I don't think we've ever seen from a contender. They are rolling out guys, a lineup that predominantly is 6 foot six. When Covington goes out there, it's about 6 foot seven. They've got a couple of big guys on the roster. Tyson Chandler is there, but they don't play all that often. So this is what the Rockets are. I mean, they're 5-3 without Clint Capella, and they're playing pretty good defense without Clint Capella. But the real test to me is going to come after the All-Star break when they play 12 of their next 20 games on the road, and we'll see what happens there. From what you've seen of the Rockets, how do you think this whole small ball experiment is going to work?
I don't know, but I will say this. I am excited to watch it. The concept that they probably felt like they knew they could not be better, they could not beat the top teams in the East at their own game. They're sitting there looking at the Lakers, looking at the Clippers. You want to toss Utah down. Whatever it is, if they felt like they couldn't be better with that lineup, and I feel like the Clint Capella, the concept of him getting traded, looking to move him, like that is, that's been something that's been brought up for quite some time now. So double down on what you think you want to do best. Like they we've seen them be all in on analytics, all in on the concepts of how they want to play, and if Daryl Morey believed that they couldn't win with two non-shooters on the floor, and obviously Russell Westbrook has been a huge part of what this lineup is, what the roster is, the moves that they've made, him alongside James Harden, if you think that this is going to help Russell Westbrook be at his very best and continue to open up the floor, and you add a guy who can knock down threes, which is part of your DNA and that can defend, and you need that help on that end. I mean, I don't think, to like, I'm not going to bet on them to be title contenders. I'm not going to bet on them that this is necessarily going to work in the long run. However, given the situation they were at, how they were playing, I think this is a gamble and a risk that I'm curious and excited to see how it works. And if you're going to go all in on how you play and the concept of how you play, this I think adds to your opportunity to exploit that. So if I were a GM or a coach, this is not the way I would construct a roster. However, I feel like the pieces and the moves and the way in which they've started funneling towards what they're going to do, then you said it, you double down on the way you want to play and see what happens. So I mean, you saw Russell Westbrook with a big game. This opened up the floor. This allowed him to be dynamic and get downhill and how he wants to operate. And so I'm curious to see it, and I don't dislike it. Answer.
They may have just maximized what they were with Clint Capella, and if you know that and you're a GM, like there's no sense going into the playoffs knowing you're a second round exit team. So at least this creates kind of the possibility you can catch lightning in a bottle and surprise teams and do something special. I'm with you though that I don't think it's gonna work, because look, it was fun watching the Utah game the other night because that was a real interesting chess match between Quinn Snyder and Mike D'Antoni. Watching Rudy Gobert defend Russell Westbrook was hilarious. Like, it's just, and look, I get the strategy. Like, you put Rudy Gobert, you stand him right there in the middle of the paint, and you say, Russ, if you want to shoot jump shots, or better yet, three-pointers, which you have not shown an ability to do, go ahead. And Russ had a big game there, but I'll tell you, Sarah, watching the whole thing, like, he was making, like, mid-range bank shots. Like, if those are the type of shots that he's going to make, you have to kind of tip your cap to him, but you'll take that if you're an opposing team. Now, you don't want to let him get downhill and get layups and get to the free throw line and all that, and he was doing most of that, I thought, when Gobert was off the floor. But as we move forward, I think you're going to see teams try to duplicate that. I think you'll see, Nikola Jokic on Russell Westbrook, Dwight Howard on Russell Westbrook. I think you'll put a smaller player on P.J. Tucker, the more consistent three-point shooter.
Yeah, and they can get out and contest. 100%. Yeah, but I like the idea that, and again, I'm not saying it's, I think it's going to work, or but given, to your point, the ceiling that they felt like they hit with Capella, this, if you catch an instance that Westbrook's hitting the shots, and that could happen, and he can get a guy like Jokic in foul trouble, you know, he can try and get downhill. You get some of those bigs in foul trouble because they're sitting back and they're waiting. You knock down some shots. There to me is more opportunity for an upside. The way Houston wants to play and the way that they analyze things, that's their identity. So to me, there is more upside in trying this than given where they could have been, I think, otherwise.
Yeah, I think you'll see some video game type numbers from Westbrook the rest of the season because he is going to have so many open looks. And if he can make those mid-range shots consistently, and even, look, if he can... You're going to get wide open looks from three. If he's going to make some of them, he could put up some big-time numbers the rest of the season. I'm just not sure that in the playoffs you're going to find ways to exploit the P.J. Tuckers of the world and get him in foul trouble. I think they're going to have some problems against those bigger teams come playoff time. But it's a roll of the dice you maybe almost had to take if you were the Houston Rockets at this point. All right, so the next couple weeks anyway, team's going to be scouring the buyout market. We've already seen Marvin Williams come off the board. He's headed to Charlotte. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is off the board. He's headed to Dallas. There are a couple of players I think teams are eyeballing. I think everybody's kind of wondering what's going to happen with Tristan Thompson. The sense was that he wasn't going to get bought out a few weeks ago, but the Cavs went out and acquired Andre Drummond. They effectively went out and signed his replacement. And Drummond's the kind of guy that everybody's wondering if he's going to opt out. I think he's going to opt in to that contract. $29 million next year, unless he's got a big deal waiting for him on the other side. He's going to be opt into that contract. So if you're Tristan Thompson, what's your future look like in Cleveland? So that's somebody I think teams are watching. Reggie Jackson in Detroit is another name that I think is out there. Jan Mahimi in Washington, though we talked about the Wizards. I don't think they're going to part with players for nothing at this point. Do you see any potential difference makers that could be out there as teams try to arm up of this final stretch?
In terms of difference makers, I would be, you're correct. Mahimi, I like. I have a hard time thinking, given what we documented with the Davis Bertans, that Washington, like, I'm not sure that actually happens. Tristan Thompson, Tristan Thompson to me is the one X factor. If he does agree to a buyout, he to me would be a potential difference maker. And whether you're looking at one of the LA teams, whether you talked about Boston, like, he's a guy I think that could change the dynamic of things. Reggie Jackson, I don't know. I mean, you look at Reggie Jackson, Tyler Johnson, like, the Lakers to me seem to be a team that if they're looking for a playmaker or a creator, someone that can fill that role, be a shooter, I don't know if those guys potentially fit the bill. I also think, like, to me, with the buyout market, or just even looking at this with guys being difference makers, you start looking at things and when playoff times come, like, all the rotations get shortened and everything gets tightened. So some of these players that would maybe be a eighth or ninth guy, does it help towards the final stretch of the regular season? Maybe. But then once you're getting in the postseason, like, is it anyone that's going to be a significant rotation player? So to me, Tristan Thompson's the one guy that I would be curious about what happens if, in fact, he agrees to buy out, and if so, where he would go and how he would impact that team. Past that, I have a hard time thinking anyone else that appears to be on the market is really going to move the needle.
Yeah, I'm with you on Thompson. I think there'd be a dogfight for him if he winds up as a free agent. Boston, I think, would be right there. The Clippers would be right there. Any number of contending teams would try to get him into the fold. He's physical. He can defend the paint. He's got championship experience. He's just the kind of guy a contender is looking for. So that's I'm with you. That's probably the one guy out there that makes the most sense at this point. Let me finish off the trade deadline and off the buyout market as well. I want to ask you about the New York Knicks, because you're there in Brooklyn, right through the tunnel is the New York Knicks, and they make a decision to hire Leon Rose. Hasn't been formally announced yet, but I've been told it's a done deal with Leon Rose to become the president of basketball operations in New York. Leon, of course, a longtime NBA agent, really respected basketball guy, built a company, basically out of Rick Brunson back in the day, then sold it to CAA and became part of that major group. So he knows the sport. He knows the intricacies of the NBA. But this is the third time, Sarah, that the Knicks have hired someone for this position that has never come close to holding this position. You had Phil Jackson, 8-9 years ago. You then transitioned to Steve Mills, and now you have Leon Rose. Like, for some reason, the Knicks think
Isaiah
experience
Thomas.
Is not...
Do you want to go back to
But I give Isaiah some credit for Toronto. Like, he ran those early years with the Raptors.
Call.
He ran basketball ops there, so at least he had some experience there. But Phil Mills... And now Leon Rose. What do you make of this decision by the Knicks to go outside the box once again in hiring a team president?
Gosh, this to me is tough just because the New York Knicks are so unique in the circumstance, the situation, the market, and the atmosphere and the environment around them right now, that the thought of someone, that's why I think it's in a lot of other places, I think to me the closest comparison would be the Lakers, just given the fact of how much attention and scrutiny surrounds that team, surrounds the organization, and in their hiring Rob Pelinka, although Magic Johnson was there and he was also coming in and didn't have a ton of that experience. I don't know, the timing to me, it seemed a little questionable. Like, why did that happen right before the trade deadline? There's obviously some candidates whose names had popped up, and whether or not you could pry them or wanted to pry them from different places, Masai Ujiri, Sam Presti, question marks about what will happen with Daryl Morey. So there to me is just a lot of questions of why and how it's kind of all played out. But with that being said, I think you said all the things about Leon Rose. He knows the landscape. Like, he understands the business. He's been through it. He is someone who I would trust would put a lot of people around him that maybe do have the experience of understanding that those front office roles and how he kind of fills in, whether it's Italian evaluators or how he fills out the rest of his people. But it's such a beast of a task ahead of pulling them from where they are. And so to try and take on that job without the past experience, I think it's a challenge, but I think it'll be a challenge, and it would be a challenge for anyone. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see. And I think the question always comes back to how much autonomy will he have? How much autonomy will he have with James Dolan, whether it's basketball decisions or personnel decisions or how that all plays out. And in that, I don't think, we know. I don't know if that's part of the prior discussions of him taking over and taking this job, but I think all of those things are hard to really forecast how it will play out, just given so many of the unknowns. But I think his resume of understanding the landscape of the NBA as an agent is so impressive that I hope the best, and I hope that he could find that nothing would be better than to have New York basketball in the New York Knicks, despite the fact I call Brooklyn games. I think it's incredible for the league. It would be incredible for the NBA and for New York, both New York and Brooklyn, if both teams were and organizations continued to improve. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. But I think it's hard. It's hard to tell at this point exactly how it'll all play out.
Well, a couple things. This has nothing to do with Leon Rose, but this is such an unoriginal thought. Like, the Knicks are looking at Golden State and how they succeeded with Bob Myers, a former agent, and they're looking at the Lakers and how Rob Pelinka is having a very good year as a GM and saying, all right, we're going to get an agent of our own. We'll get the number one agent at CAA and have him run our basketball operations. Like, that to me is part of all this. The biggest issue I have, and you kind of touched on this, the timing of it all. Like, they fire Steve Mills on the Tuesday before the trade deadline, and word leaks on Thursday that they're hiring Leon Rose. What the hell are you rushing through this for? Like, what is with the speed with which you have to operate? You have a competent general manager in place in Scott Perry. Scott Perry very easily could have run the team through the trade deadline, through the buyout market stuff, and then gone into the offseason when you could have made a decision. Like, what was the rush? Like, what was the need to appoint Leon Rose to this position? I mean, it's not like Leon was, you know, going to take the president of basketball operations job in Sacramento. Like, this Knicks job was always going to be there. I didn't understand that. Like, you're the New York Knicks. Why wouldn't you take a couple of months, do a national search, and see what your franchise and, like, $10 million a year can buy you? Like, I can tell you, it'll buy you a lot. Like, a lot of GMs, and you know this, a lot of GMs still have an interest in the New York Knicks. They still believe
without a doubt.
If you can turn the Knicks into a competent franchise, like, if you can turn them into a competent franchise, you can lure free agents and you can become a winner right away. And they know that the next GM that turns the Knicks into a champion is going to be immortalized. You will be a legend in the New York scene. Because look, with all due respect to the Nets, winning in New York with the Knicks is a bigger deal at this point. So if you do that, you're able to become a icon in the New York area. Why they wouldn't take a little bit of time and flesh out the market, like find out what the asking price would be from Toronto to get Masai Ujiri out of his contract. I frankly don't think a first-round pick would be too much to give for Masai Ujiri. I really wouldn't. I would look to Oklahoma and to Sam Presti, the usual suspects, R.C. Buford. Or I'd look to, you know, the second-tier guys, Bobby Webster in Toronto. I'd look to, you know, Arturas out in Denver. You'd look to a number of different places. Justin Zanuck in Utah. The Jazz have been excellent in developing players, signing free agents, drafting guys. Justin Zanuck, another former agent who has got experience working in Milwaukee and now Utah. Why wouldn't you call him? Like, this is feels like, once again, the Knicks rushing into a decision without fully fleshing out why they're doing it. And that to me is a problem. I think Leon Rose, there's no reason to believe Leon couldn't be successful in this job and shouldn't get this job. I just wish they had taken more time in the process for such a critical job at a critical point in the franchise's tenure.
Yes. Yeah, and you said it all. And you went through all the candidates. You went through, I mean, just even all the possibilities. And I'm with you. And I really do. I hope that Leon Rose has a ton of success. And to your point, there's a lot of reasons that point to why he should and why he can. But yeah, it's the timing of all of it, how it came down, how it kind of came out of nowhere. You know, if that's the circumstance of something they were thinking about, had already identified him as a candidate or candidates, surprising that when they fired David Fizdale and the changes they made at the beginning of the year, like it was odd, right? You know, the couple days before the trade deadline, that seems like the worst time that you want to be making a change of that magnitude. However, yeah, it'll be interesting. And to your point, he still needs to get out of all his contractual obligations with CAA. And
that'll take a while. That'll take a while and to unring those bells and unravel all that, which is why you haven't seen any kind of official announcement. Like, that's a big part of all that. Like, not like James Dolan had some statement out there. I love that statement, by the way, a 2-sentence garbled statement where he it felt like that statement was just released so Dolan could say, "I'm not selling." Like, right. This is after, for context, he has been getting pelted with chants of sell the team in recent games. So I feel like that statement was put out there in large part so Dolan could say he's not selling. Like, that to me felt like it was it. Now, Sarah, we're recording this on Tuesday, so I haven't seen the clip of this yet, but I've seen all over Twitter the appearance that the Knicks' new rebranding consultant, Steve Stout, he was on ESPN apparently today, talking about how they're going to rebrand the Knicks and the things that they're going to do to make this team more appealing moving forward. He compared himself, I guess, to Drake and what Drake did in Toronto. what are we doing here? Like, what are we doing? Like,
yeah, and that's, I mean, they're the New York Knicks. To me, it's not about rebranding. It's about just finding ways to win.
Yes, it's about, like, how about, like...
Like, no,
and,
it's...
Look, I'm not a general...
I was just gonna say. They're an iconic organization. I mean, I don't think a rebranding is what needs to be done. More of it, fans and Knicks fans and fans of the league just want to see a better team on the floor, frankly. They just want to see a team that wins. And because you have all the makings of the brand that anyone would want. So
they do. And look, it doesn't get whittled down to one or two decisions, but where would the Knicks be right now if, and I don't want to dump on Kevin Knox, because I think we have a tendency to give up on young players too early, and I think Kevin Knox absolutely could still have a very long career. But what if the Knicks had decided to take Michael Porter Jr. and wait for a year for him to get fully healthy? Like, there's no such thing as a career-ending injury in the NBA. It doesn't exist. You know, we've seen time and again guys come back from major injuries, especially even more so when guys are teenagers when they're drafted. Like, where would the Knicks be if they had in New York Michael Porter Jr. doing what he's doing right now in Denver? Like, the Nuggets were able to part with Malik Beasley and make the deals that they did in part because Michael Porter Jr. is there and looks like the player we thought was a consensus top three pick before the injury problems kicked in. Like, it's a little thing, but it's pretty simple. You have Michael Porter Jr., all of a sudden, you've got R.J. Barrett, you've got Michael Porter Jr., and you've got a foundation of two key young players. Instead, you've got R.J. Barrett,
you've got Mitchell Robinson,
whatever.
I'd toss in Mitchell Robinson, but I feel like there's some pieces.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
that's why this is so critical in such an important, because most of the rest of the roster is on 1 year deals on expiring contracts. So now is a time where if you make the right decisions and be very smart about what you're doing, and whether it's free agency, whether it's with the draft, there can be a light at the end of the tunnel of the path you're going to take. But it's all about the vision, and that's why, you know, this your hiring of the new president of basketball operations is so crucial, especially at this time.
It's just a hamster wheel that we get on with the Knicks. They keep making these decisions that are obviously and blatantly questionable, and it turns out those decisions aren't the right ones, and then they go out and do the exact same thing again. Look, if Leon is, and I'm sure he's going to give an autonomy to hire staff, but if he's able to surround himself with former GMs and executives that are out there that make sense, he can be successful. But I just would have liked to have seen the Knicks take their time, do a national search, and see what kind of talent they'd be able to recruit with all their money and all their resources. That, to me, would have been the smart thing to do. But guess we'll see what happens. Sarah, always appreciate you coming in. Always great to talk to you. Thanks for joining me this week.
Thanks for having me, Maddox. I love it.